All right, hi, and thank you. So tonight, I'm gonna continue with this book. I started with this book last week, Consciousness and the Absolute, Final Talks of Srinivas Gadadhara Maharaj. And we did the first conversation in this book last week, so we'll start the second one. But again, the conversations aren't numbered. They're dated. And this one is dated May 10, 1980. And it's a little longer, so I don't know if we'll be able to finish it in half an hour. We'll see what happens. I'm going to wet my whistle first. Here we go. It starts off with Nisargadatta speaking. How did I get to the truth that I prevail everlastingly? By meditating on the meditator. By I amness, merging into I amness. Only then did I understand what my true nature is. The great sages meditated in the same way. Nobody had told me how to do it. I did not seek this knowledge externally. It sprouted within me. I meditated like the sages and saw a vision. Initially, there was space. And in the space, I saw the principles embodied. Actually, they have no bodies, but in my vision, they had bodies. I called them Prakriti and Purusha, the male and female aspects of cosmic consciousness. Until the union of Prakriti and Purusha, the dynamic, all-pervading consciousness lay in a dormant state. In the union of the male and female aspects, emissions were planted in the female of these figures. When these emissions merged in the womb, they started taking form. After 9 months of gestation, an infant was delivered. That consciousness, which was planted in the womb, was the causal body, the lingadiya. In that lingadiya, the knowledge, I am, was in a dormant condition. This is what I saw in meditation. So what he is sharing here is a vision that he had early, as far as I can tell, early in his meditative experience, because he's saying he didn't know how to meditate. You know, he just had this one conversation with his guru, which Ron read to us a little bit ago. And so he went off and was going to meditate, and he didn't know how. And so somehow this vision kind of communicated with him and gave him the sense of really what he was meditating on. And I don't know this for a fact, but this is what's arising in me, so I'll just go ahead and say it. He says the consciousness which was planted in the womb was the causal body, the lingadiya. And that lingadiya, the knowledge I am, was in a dormant condition. This is what he saw in meditation. So the feeling that's coming to me is that, you know, what he saw was that prior to birth, the I am consciousness is not aware like it is for us now. And so he knew from this vision that the I am consciousness was something that becomes aware at birth, and prior to birth it isn't. And that would give him an indication of two things. One, it tells him what he's looking for, because he's trying to learn how to meditate. So now he gets a clue of what this I am is. It's that sense that's there the moment you're born. You know, before you've learned anything, right? But he also, from this vision, knows that there's still something prior to that I am. You know, because it was there in the womb before the I am became aware, right? He calls it in a dormant condition. So this kind of this vision kind of gave him hints on what to look for in meditation. First the I am, and then what's beyond the I am, right? The questioner says, how did we lose this pure consciousness state? I'll tell you one thing. This is just a kind of a side comment, but I'm sometimes amazed by his questioners. Sometimes I'm amazed by how they don't understand what he just said. And sometimes I'm amazed by how they did understand what he just said. This time I was like, wow, you understood exactly what he was talking about. That's amazing. How did we lose this pure consciousness state? Nisargadatta says, every being experiences the Asvara state either directly or potentially. But he is so wrapped up in this objective world that he loses his identity. You must know what this I am principle is. It appears spontaneously, and with its appearance begins the riddle of conceptual life. So, first of all, what's really important here, and again, this is what I talked about, I think, today in the Tao Te Ching teaching, enlightened leadership teaching, is the real problem is that we're addicted to outward focus. And that's what he says, that, every being experiences this Isvara state, either directly or potentially, but he is so wrapped up in this objective world that he loses his identity, right? We're so focused outwardly on the world and our thoughts about the world that we're not aware of the I am presence. You know, everybody obviously has the I am presence, has the I am sense. It's the most obvious thing in the world. And yet at the same time, not at all aware of it, give no attention to it, give no even thought to it, most people, right? He says, you must know what this I am principle is. You must come to be aware of that sense again, just that sense, I am. Seems like I kind of remember in meditation today, there was this, I don't always search for the I am sense. That's not, I'm more of an awareness, watching awareness type. But this morning when I was meditating, I shifted into feeling for the I am sense. And again, you know, the ego in me, and I don't know if it's the same in everybody, but the ego in me, whenever I'm trying to do anything, whether I'm trying to watch awareness or whether I'm trying to shift into the I am sense, one thing the ego always does is it tries to land on an object and trick me. So like if I'm searching for the I am sense, it'll feel the feeling of life in the body and say, there it is. I say, no, that's not it. You know, it's always trying to find things. And so what was really interesting today as I was looking at the I am sense, being aware of the I am sense, is it wasn't any of the things the ego wanted to pin it on, right? It wasn't the feeling of aliveness in the body, for example. Because the I am sense is always there, even when there's not an awareness of this feeling of aliveness. You know, the I am sense is invisible. And yet it is the most obvious fact about each of us that there is. Last week I was working in the on the mitigation work that I'm doing here in La Vida. We go out and we take down trees and haul them off into piles. We pick up sticks and all this kind of stuff. And I was lopping some small trees that were trying to grow near the river shore. And I was lopped my way into a nest of snakes, an entire nest. And the first snakes that I saw were little babies. And they were on this stick, which I unfortunately had to pick up and take away. But they were laying on the stick, you know, trying to get some sun. And when they looked at me, you know, the I am sense was very strong. They had the same I am sense that I have, you know. It's just that sense of I exist. It doesn't have a feeling to it. People often are looking for the feeling, but it doesn't have a feeling to it. It has a knowing to it. You know, and those little snakes had the same knowing, right? And then their parents came out and then more babies, and I realized I was in a nest, but and I was a little careful at first because I'm not smart about snakes. I didn't know what kind they were. But once, you know, someone came over and shared with me that they were fine, I just went ahead and worked in the nest. They just kept watching me and I just kept watching them. They were really cute. But I guess the point I want to make is, he says, you must know what this I am principle is. And I think what makes it so challenging for people is, again, compared to something like a feeling, like a sensation, it's nothing. And yet it's not nothing, because it's inherently known in every person, right? And you have to be able to just be aware of this, even though it has no feeling, it has no taste, it has no appearance. The question says, how do I start this search for myself? Nisargadatta says, start from the very beginning. In this gross world, I began with my parents, because I knew full well that my principle was already dwelling there in the collection of their bodily elements out of which I emanated. But I came to the conclusion that I could not be that principle which came from the mother's body. There is nobody here who is 100 years old. Does that mean that 100 years ago, you did not exist? So what Nisargadatta is saying here, he is explaining the thought process he went through. Here the key word, thought. The thought process he went through when he first started contemplating, in effect, what am I and where did I come from? And he's saying the very first thing he started with was, well, people tell me I came from my parents. Let's start there, right? Very basic thing. Because as he started contemplating this I am presence and the physical body of his mother, and could that really be where it came from, he came to the conclusion, no. Like the body came from the body of his mother, right? But the I am presence could not have. You know, he says, you know, the I am presence is older than the mother's body. How could it have come from the mother's body? You know, that must not be where I come from. And that reminds me very much of what Jesus said in the Bible. Jesus said, before Abraham was, I am. Right? How could the I am come from the mother's body? That must not be where I come from. Again, he ends this by saying, there is nobody here who is 100 years old. Does that mean that 100 years ago you did not exist? Of course, he's referring to the I am principle. The questioner says, I don't know. Nisargadatta says, the one who said, I don't know, must have been there. In short, you were not like this, but you must have been something. You must comprehend this correctly. 100 years back, I was not like this. So the one pointing this out must have been there. You did and do exist unto eternity. What I am expounding does not relate to worldly knowledge. You do not want to give up either worldly knowledge or so-called spiritual knowledge, and yet, through these worldly concepts, you want to understand the riddle of your existence. And that is precisely why you are not able to understand. In truth, your state is one of absolute bliss. It's not this phenomenal state. In that phenomenal state, you are full of bliss, but there is no experience of its presence. Oh, in that non-phenomenal state, you are full of bliss, but there is no experience of its presence. In that state, there is no trace of misery or unhappiness, only unalloyed bliss. What am I talking about? And the questioner answers, bliss. So, the closest example I have to this, which is a silly example, but it's just what I have, and I think I've probably told you guys this before. You know, I've been operated on, well, not really operated on. One was a, you know, when they go in and they check out your colon, what do they call it, colonoscopy. That's not really being operated on. The other one was operated on. It's when they put my artificial wrist in. I have an artificial wrist now because I destroyed the other one. But when they put me under for the different procedures, when I woke up from the anesthesia, you know, you don't remember anything at all from these procedures because you're out with the anesthesia. But when I woke up from the anesthesia, there was this knowledge, not quite a memory, but a knowledge that I had just been in pure bliss. And I remember I even said to one of the nurses, you know, like, you know, that was incredible, you know, or something like that. And she said to me, don't like it too much. That's what killed Michael Jackson. And that stuck with me. I thought, yeah, Michael Jackson somehow knew it was bliss too. You're like, how do you know that when you have no mental memory of it? But yet there was this knowing. And Michael Jackson must have known it too, because he paid a doctor to do it to him, you know, regularly, right, to put him under. So beyond the mind, there is something. But the mind can't know it. That's amazing to me. I can see why people are afraid of beyond the mind, because to the mind, that appears to be death, right? Because it's beyond the mind, it appears to be death. But it's not death. It's a different level of existence. And the only way that we can know what that is to go there, which is to go beyond the mind. And we have these marvelous examples like Nisargadatta Maharaj and Ramana Maharshi, just to name two, who have established themselves beyond mind. And then my words stop. I don't know what to say about that other than it is inspiring for at least some of us to seek and see if we can find out directly what it is that they know. You know, when I read the word bliss, I don't think happiness. Happiness to me is more of a perceptual experience, right? You know, I feel happy. That's a perceptual experience. Bliss, I think, is completely beyond perception. I don't think that we should even try to imagine it, because I don't think that we can. He calls it a non-phenomenal state. In that non-phenomenal state, you are full of bliss, but there is no experience of its presence. What the heck does that mean? I don't know, but I get all excited in the chest just reading the sentence. You know, I'm 58 years old. I don't know how long I have to live, but I'm definitely on the latter end of the lifetime, right? Rather than the beginning end. I want to find out what the heck this sentence means. In that non-phenomenal state, you are full of bliss, but there is no experience of its presence. What the heck does that mean? There's one thing I know. It means something other than my current experience of life. He's talking about something other than what I experience. That I know for a fact. And he's not the only one that talks about it. And they call it reality. I want to know what that is. In that state, there is no trace of misery or unhappiness, only unalloyed bliss. And then he says, what am I talking about? And the questioner says, bliss. Nisargadatta says, because you want some satisfaction according to your own concepts, you try to qualify unalloyed bliss. Now, I think that what I was just saying is I actually don't try to qualify it. You know, I recognize that I don't know what it is. I don't say it's happiness. It's really, really happy. You know, I don't do that, because to me, happiness is almost like on a different plane, right? Bliss is in a completely different realm of description. But he says to the questioner that you try to qualify unalloyed bliss. The term ananda, which is the word for bliss, the term ananda has significance only when it signifies that the bodily beingness is available to experience it. When you are in deep sleep and you start to see forms, you're actually dreaming. Aren't those dream forms coming from your own beingness? Whatever you see, even in the waking state, doesn't it come from your own beingness, which is dwelling within the body? In deep sleep, consciousness was in a dormant condition. There were no bodies, no concepts, no encumbrances. Upon the arrival of this apparently wakeful state, with the arrival of the concept I am, the love of I am woke up. That itself is Maya, illusion. So he is distinguishing again between the I am and bliss. He's saying that the I am doesn't know bliss. The I am knows illusion. One of the things that shows up in my contemplation a lot is that I'm going to die. And maybe we would really call that the I am going back into the dormant state, right? Since there is no death. But this sense of me as Regina, although it's hard to imagine. I mean, that's one of the things I wrote in my journal recently. Like, I can't actually imagine no me. All I've ever known is a me. but I know intellectually I'm going to die because so many others have, right? Now, when the masters talk about waking up beyond the I am presence, they also sometimes call that ego death or death of the mind. And sometimes people are afraid. They're afraid of ego death, afraid of death of the mind. But I kind of look at it and I say, you know what? This thing's going to die anyway. So why not die that way, death of the mind, before the body dies, and find out what the heck he's talking about? You know, the bliss. Why not do that? I mean, I'm going to die anyway. I'm already on that end of life. You know, I don't know exactly where that hill is, but I think it's around 50, and I'm 58. So I'm on the other side of the hill. I'm on the downhill side of life. I'm going to die anyway. What have I got to lose? That's kind of how I look at it, right? It's not like I can save this body from death. It's not like I can save even this Regina I Am presence from death, or at least from dormancy. I think it's really important. I've actually received a couple of complaints about my teaching lately, but I'm going to have to continue in spite of the complaints. I think it's important to realize that the I Am presence is part of the illusion. Yay, Ron's with me. George is with me. I think that's important because otherwise you might just achieve some happy state that you think is it, and it's not it, and your I Am is going to die and go back to the dormant state, which sages refer to as death. Apparently, going into the dormant state without enlightenment and being enlightened is not the same thing, and I can't say I know the difference, but when the I Am goes into the dormant state, the sages call that death. When the I Am dies, the sages call that enlightenment. There's some kind of a difference there. And although I don't, you know, I could never tell you what it is. Oh, you want to say something, Ron? Go ahead.
I have wondered recently whether or not, in a sense, this may sound crazy, really off the wall, but that we are the... I shouldn't use the word first aid rescue kit, but we are that somehow within us is this as that consciousness had its self-saving mechanism, that we are part of that trigger.
Mm.
Come back and actually remind consciousness of what it really is.
Yes.
And we are able to apply that first aid appropriately when we are realized, and when we aren't, we go dormant. We're not. And again, maybe that's a wild, crazy way of putting it, but I almost wonder whether it's a self-saving mechanism.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, thank you. Well, it is interesting to contemplate that those are our choices, going dormant or dying, and dying is actually the better choice. Right? Dying means no more mind, no more I Am presence, but then you get to find out what bliss is. So with that, I'm going to have to stop because we're out of time. So we'll come back next week and we'll continue with this particular conversation. And to all of you who don't want to hear this, I apologize. I have to teach this now. I have no choice because it's the only thing that interests me. Thank you.